Cassette 16, Side 2. Back to Mars, the red planet, the most beautiful world in the solar system, the only real world. Their shuttle accelerated, made its turn, floated a few days, decelerated. And in 2 weeks they were in the lineup for Clark, and then on the elevator going down, down, down. So slow, this final descent. Zoe looked out at Echus, there to the northeast, between Red Tharsis and the blue North Sea. So good to see it. Zoe ate several tabs of Pandorf as the elevator car made its approach into Sheffield, and when she walked out into the socket, and then through the streets between the glossy stone buildings to the giant train station on the rim, she was in the rapture of the Areophany, loving every face she saw, loving all her tall brothers and sisters with their striking beauty and their phenomenal grace, loving even the Terrans running around underfoot. The train to Echus didn't leave for a couple of hours, and so she walked the Rim Park restlessly for a time, looking down into the great Pavonis Mons caldera, as spectacular as anything on Miranda, even if it wasn't as deep as Prospero's Rift. Infinity of horizontal banding, all the shades of red, tan, crimson, rust, umber, maroon, copper, brick, sienna, paprika, oxblood, cinnabar, vermilion, all under the dark, star-studded afternoon sky. Her world. Though Sheffield was under its tent and would ever be, and she wanted back in the wind again. So she went back to the station and got on the train for Echus and felt the train fly down the piste, off the great cone of Pavonis, down the pure xeriscape of East Tharsis, to Cairo and a Swiss precision exchange onto the train north to Echus Overlook. The train came in near midnight, and she checked in at the co-op's hostel and walked over to the Adler, feeling the last of the Pandorf buzz through her like the feather in the cap of her happiness, and the whole gang was there as if no time had passed, and they cheered to see her. They all hugged her, singly and severally. They all kissed her. They gave her drinks and asked questions about her trip, and told her about the recent wind conditions, and caressed her in her chair, until quickly it was the hour before dawn, and they all trooped down to the ledge and suited up and took off. Out into the darkness of the sky and the exhilarating lift of the wind, all of it coming back instantly, like breathing or sex, the black mass of the Echus escarpment bulking to the east like the edge of a continent, the dim floor of Echus Chasma so far below, the landscape of her heart with its dim lowland and high plateau, and the vertiginous cliff between them, and over it all the intense purples of the sky, lavender and mauve in the east, black indigo out to the west, the whole arch lightening and taking on color each second, the stars popping out of existence, high clouds to the west flaring pink. And as several stoops had taken her well below the level of Overlook, she was able to close on the cliff and catch a hard westerly updraft and sail on it, inches over Underlook, and then up in a tight gyre, motionless herself, and yet cast violently up by the wind, until she burst out of the shadow of the cliff into the raw yellows of the new day, an incredibly joyful combination of the kinetic and the visual, of sense and world, and as she soared up into the clouds she thought, "To hell with you, Anne Claiborne! You and the rest of your kind can go on forever about your moral imperatives, your essay ethics, values, goals, strictures, responsibilities, virtues, grand purposes of life. You can pour out those words to the end of time in all their hypocrisy and fear, and still you will never have a feeling like this one, when the grace of mind and body and world are all in perfect consort. You can rant your Calvinist rant, until you are blue in the face. What humans should do with their brief lives, as if there were any way to tell for sure, as if you didn't turn out to be a bunch of cruel bastards in the end. But until you get out here and fly, surf, climb, jump, exert yourself somehow in the risk of space, in the pure grace of the body, you just don't know. You have no right to speak. You are slaves to your ideas and your hierarchies, and so can't see that there's no higher goal than this, the ultimate purpose of existence, of the cosmos itself, the free play of flight. In the northern spring, the trade winds blew, pushing against the westerlies and damping the Echis updrafts. Jackie was on the Grand Canal, distracted from her interplanetary maneuverings by the tedium of local politics. Indeed, she seemed irritated and tense at having to deal with it, and clearly she didn't want Zoe around. So Zoe went to work in the mines at Moreux for a while, and then joined a group of flying friends on the coast of the North Sea, south of Boone's Neck near Blocks Hoffnung, where the sea cliffs reared a kilometer out of the crashing surf. Late afternoon onshore breezes hit these cliffs and sent up a small flock of flyers wheeling through sea stacks that poked out of tapestries of foam surging up and down, pure white on the wine-dark sea. This flying group was led by a young woman Zoe hadn't met before, a girl of only 9 M-years named Melka. She was the best flyer Zoe had ever seen. When she was in the air leading them, it was as if an angel had come into their midst, darting through them like a raptor through doves, at other times leading them through the tight maneuvers that made flocking such fun. And so Zoe worked through the days at her co-op's local partner, and flew every day after her work stint was over. And her heart was always soaring, pleased by one thing after another. Once she even called Anne Claiborne to try to tell her about flying, about what it really meant. But the old one had nearly forgotten who she was and didn't appear interested even when Zoe managed to make it clear when and how they had met. That afternoon she flew with an ache inside. The past was a dead letter, sure, but that people could become such ghosts. Nothing for such a feeling but sun and salt air, the ever-changing spill of sea foam rising and falling against the cliffs. There was Melka diving. Zoe chased her, feeling a sudden rush of affection for such a beautiful spirit. But then Melka saw her and tipped away and clipped the highest rock of a sea stack with the end of one wing and tumbled down like a shot bird. Shocked at the sight of the accident, Zoe pulled her wings in and began dolphin-kicking downward next to the sea stack until she was plummeting in a powerful stoop. She caught up the tumbling girl in her arms. She flapped one wing just over the blue waves while Melka struggled under her. Then she saw that they were going to have to swim. Part 12. It goes so fast. They walked down to the low bluffs overlooking the Florentine. It was night, the air still and cool, the stars bunched overhead in their thousands. They strode side by side on the bluff trail, looking down at the beaches below. The black water was smooth, pricked everywhere by reflected starlight and the long smeared line reflecting Suda Phobos setting in the east, leading the eye to the dim black mass of land across the bay.
I'm worried, yes, very worried. In fact, I'm scared.
Why?
It's Maya, her mind, her mental problems, her emotional problems, they're getting worse.
What are the symptoms?
The same, only worse. She can't sleep at night. She hates the way she looks sometimes. She's still in her manic-depressive cycle, but it's changing somehow. I don't know how to characterize it. As if she can't always remember where in the cycle she is. Bouncing around in it. She forgets things, a lot of things.
We all do.
I know, but Maya is forgetting things that I would have said were essentially Mayan. She doesn't seem to care. That's the worst part. She doesn't seem to care.
I find that hard to imagine.
Me too. Maybe it's just the depressive part of her mood cycle, now predominating. But there are days when she loses all affect.
What you call jamais vu.
No, not exactly. She has those incidents too, mind you. Like a certain kind of pre-stroke symptom. I know, I know. I told you I'm scared. But I don't know what this is, not really. She has jamais vus that are like a pre-stroke symptom. She has presque vus, where she feels almost on the edge of a revelation that never comes. That often happens to people in pre-epileptic auras. I have feelings like that myself. Yes, I suppose we all do. Sometimes it seems like things will come clear, and then the feeling goes away. Yes, but for Maya, these are very intense, as in everything. Better than the loss of effect. Oh, yes, I agree. Presque-vu is not so bad. It's déjà vu that is the worst, and she has periods of continuous déjà vu that can last up to a week. Those are devastating to her. They rob the world of something she can't live without. Contingency. Free will. Perhaps. But the net effect of all these symptoms is to drive her into a state of apathy, almost catatonia. Tried to avoid any of the abnormal states by not feeling too much, not feeling at all. They say one of the common Issei ailments is falling into a funk. Yes, I've been reading about that. Loss of affectual function. Anomie. Apathy. They've been treating it as they would catatonia or schizophrenia, giving them a serotonin-dopamine complex, limbic stimulants, a big cocktail, as you can imagine. Brain chemistry. I've been dosing her with everything I can think of, I must admit, keeping journals, running tests, sometimes with her cooperation, sometimes without her knowing much about it. I've been doing what I can, I swear I have. I'm sure you have. But it isn't working, she's losing it. Oh, Sax. He stopped, held on to his friend's shoulder. I can't bear it if she goes. She was always such an airy spirit. We are earth and water, fire and air, and Maya was always in flight. Such an airy spirit, flying on her own gales up above us. I can't stand to see her falling like this. Ah, well. They walked on. It's nice to have Phobos back again. Yes, that was a good idea of yours. It was your idea, actually. You suggested it to me. Did I? I don't remember that. You did. Below them, the sea crunched faintly on rocks. These four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, one of your semantic rectangles. It's from the Greeks, like the four temperaments. Yes. Thales made the hypothesis, the first scientist. But there were always scientists, you told me, all the way back to the savannah. Yes, that's true. And the Greeks, all honor to them. They were obviously great minds. But they were only part of a continuum of scientists, you know. There has been some work done since. Yes, I know. Yes. And some of that subsequent work might be of use to you in these conceptual schemata of yours, in mapping the world for us, so that you might be given new ways of seeing things that might help you, even with problems like Maya's. Because there are more than four elements, 120, more or less. Maybe there are more than four temperaments as well. Maybe 120 of them, eh? And the nature of these elements, well, things have gotten strange since the Greeks. You know, subatomic particles have an attribute called spin that comes only in multiples of 1/2. And you know how an object in our visible world, it spins 360 degrees and is back to its original position? Well, a particle with a spin designated 1/2, like a proton or a neutron, it has to rotate through 720 degrees to get back to its original configuration. What's that? It has to go through a double rotation relative to ordinary objects to come back to its starting state. You're kidding. No, no. This has been known for centuries. The geometry of space is simply different for spin 1/2 particles. They live in a different world. And so? Well, I don't know. but it seems suggestive to me. I mean, if you're going to use physical models as analogs for our mental states and throw them together in the patterns that you do, then perhaps you ought to be considering these somewhat newer physical models. To think of Maya as a proton, perhaps, a spin one-half particle living in a world twice as big as ours. Ah, and it gets stranger than that. There are 10 dimensions to this world, Michel. 10. The 3 of macrospace that we can perceive, the 1 of time, and then 6 more micro-dimensions, compactified around the fundamental particles in ways we can describe mathematically but cannot visualize. Convolutions and topologies, differential geometries, invisible but real, down at the ultimate level of space-time. Think about it. It could lead to whole new systems of thought for you, a vast new enlargement of your mind. I don't care about my mind. I only care about Maya. Yes, I know. They stood looking over the starry water. Over them arched the dome of stars, and in the silence the air breathed over them. The sea mumbled below. The world seemed a big place, wild and free, dark and mysterious. After a time, they turned and began walking back along the trail. One time I was taking the train from Da Vinci to Sheffield, and there was some problem with the piste, and we stopped for a while in Underhill. I got off and took a walk through the old trailer park, and I started remembering things. Just looking around, I wasn't really trying, but things came to me.
A common phenomenon.
Yes, so I understand. But I wonder if it might not help Maya to do something like that. Not Underhill in particular, but all the places where she was happy, where the two of you were happy. You're living in Sabashii now, but why not move back to some place like Odessa?
She didn't want to.
She might have been wrong. Why don't you try living in Odessa and visiting Underhill from time to time, or Sheffield, Cairo, maybe even Nicosia, the South Pole cities, Dorsa Brevia, a dive into Burrows, a train tour of the Hellas Basin. All that kind of return might help her to stitch herself together, to see again where our story began, where we were formed for good or ill in the morning of the world. She might need that, whether she knows it or not. Arm in arm, they walked back to the crater, following a dim track through dark bracken.
Bless you, Sax. Bless you.
The water of Isidus Bay was the color of a bruise or a clematis petal, sparkling with sunlight that glanced off waves just on the verge of white-capping. The swell was from the north, and the cabin cruiser pitched and yawed as they motored northwest from Dumarthurey Harbor. A bright day in spring, LS 51, M year 79, AD 2181. Maya sat on the upper deck of the boat, drinking in the sea air and the flood of blue sunlight. It was a joy to be out on the water like this, away from all the haze and junk on shore. Wonderful the way the sea couldn't be tamed or changed in any way. Wonderful how when one got out of the sight of land, one rocked on blue wilderness again, always the same no matter what happened back there. She could have sailed on. All day, every day, and each slide down the waves a little roller coaster ride of the soul. But that wasn't what they were about. There ahead, whitecaps broke over a broad patch, and beside her, the boat's pilot brought the wheel over a spoke or two and knocked the throttle down a few RPM. That whitewater was the top of Double-Decker Butte, now a reef marked by a black buoy, clanging a deep bong, 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 bong. Mooring buoys were scattered around this big nautical church bell. Their pilot steered to the nearest one. There were no other boats anchored here or visible anywhere. It was as if they were alone in the world. Michelle came up from below and stood by her, hand on her shoulder, as the pilot cut the throttle, and a sailor in the bow below them reached out with a boat hook and snagged the buoy, clipped their mooring rope onto it. The pilot killed the engine, and they drifted back on the swells till the mooring line tugged them short into one swell, with a loud slap and a fan of white spray. They were at anchor over Burrows. Down in the cabin, Maya got out of her clothes and pulled on a flexible orange dry suit. Suit and hood, booties, tank and helmet, lastly gloves. She had only learned to dive for this descent, and every part of it was still new except for the sensation of being underwater, which was like the weightlessness of space. So once she got over the side of the boat and into the water, it was a familiar feeling. Sinking down, pulled by the weight belt, aware that the water around her was cold, but not feeling it in any real way. Breathing underwater. That was odd, but it worked. Down into the dark. She let go and swam down, away from the little pin of sunlight. Down and down, past the upper edge of Double-Decker Butte, past its silvered or coppery windows, standing in rows like mineral extrusions or the one-way mirrors of observers from another dimension. Quickly gone in the murk, however, and she dream-parachuted down again, down and down. Michelle and a couple others were following her, but it was so dark that she couldn't see them. Then a robot trawl shaped like a thick bed frame sank past them all, its powerful headlights shooting forward long cones of crystalline fluidity, cones so long that they became one blurry, diffuse cylinder, flowing this way and that as the trawl dipped and bobbed, striking now a distant mesa's metallic windows, now the black muck down on the rooftops of the old Niederdorf. Somewhere down there, the Niederdorf canal had run, there, a gleam of white teeth. The Barice columns, impervious white under their diamond coating, about half buried in black sand and muck. She pulled up and kicked her fins back and forth a few times to stop descending, then pushed a button that shot some compressed air into one part of her weight belt to stabilize herself. She floated then over the canal like a ghost. Yes, it was like Scrooge's dream, the trawl, a kind of robot Christmas past, illuminating the drowned world of lost time, the city she had loved so much. Sudden darts of pain lanced through her ribs. Mostly she was numb to any feeling. It was too strange, too hard to understand or believe that this was Burrows, her Burrows, now Atlantis at the bottom of a Martian sea. Bothered by her lack of feeling, she kicked hard and swam down the canal park over the salt columns and farther west. There on the left loomed Hunt Mesa, where she and Michelle had lived in hiding over a dance studio, then the broad black upslope of Great Escarpment Boulevard. Ahead lay Princess Park, where in the Second Revolution she had stood on a stage and given a speech to a huge throng. The crowd had stood just below where she was floating now. Over there, that was where she and Nergal had spoken. Now the black bottom of a bay. All of that, so long ago. Her life. They had cut open the tent and walked away from the city. They had flooded it and never looked back. Yes, no doubt Michelle was right. This dive was a perfect image of the murky processes of memory, and maybe it would help to see it. And yet, Maya felt her numbness and doubted it. The city was drowned, sure, but it was still here. Anytime they wanted to, someone could rebuild the dike and pump out this arm of the bay, and there the city would be again, drenched and steaming in the sunlight, safely enclosed in a polder as if it were some town in the Netherlands. Wash down the muddy streets, plant street grass and trees, clean out the mesa interiors and the houses and the shops down in the Niederdorf, and up the broad boulevards, polish the windows, and there you would have it all again.
burrows Mars, on the surface and gleaming. It could be done. It even made sense, almost, given how much excavation there had been in the Nine Maces, given that Isidus Bay had no other good harbor. Well, no one would ever do it. But it could be done. And so it wasn't really like the past at all. Numb, and feeling more and more chill, Maya shot more air into the weight belt, turned and swam back up the length of Canal Park, back toward the light trawl. Again she spotted the row of salt columns, and something about them drew her. She kicked down to them, then swam just over the black sand, disturbing the rippled surface with the downdraft from her fins. The rows of Barice columns had bracketed the old canal. They looked more tumbled down than ever, now that their symmetricality was ruined by half-burial. She remembered taking afternoon walks in the park, west, into the sun, then back, with the light pouring past them. It had been a beautiful place. Down among the great mesas, it had been like being in a giant city of many cathedrals. There beyond the columns was a row of buildings. The buildings were the anchoring point for a line of kelp. Long trunks rose from their roofs into the murk, their broad leaves undulating gently in a slow current. There had been a cafe in the front of that end building, a sidewalk cafe, partly shaded by a trellis covered with wisteria. The last salt column served as a marker, and Maya was sure of her identification. She swam laboriously into a standing position, and the time came back to her. Frank had shouted at her and run off, no rhyme or reason as usual with him. She had dressed and followed him, and found him here, hunched over a coffee. Yes. She had confronted him, and they had argued right there. She had berated him for not hurrying up to Sheffield. She had knocked the coffee cup off the table, and the handle had broken off and spun on the ground. Frank got up, and they walked away arguing, and went back to Sheffield. But no. No, that wasn't how it had been. They had quarreled, yes, but then made up. Frank had reached across the table and held her hand, and a great black weight had lifted off her heart, giving her a brief moment of grace, of being in love and being loved. One or the other. But which had it been? She couldn't remember, couldn't be sure. So many fights with Frank, so many reconciliations. Both could have happened. It was impossible to keep track, to remember what had happened when. It was all blurring together in her mind, into vague impressions, disconnected moments, the past disappearing entirely. Small noises, like an animal in pain. Ah! That was her throat. Mewling, sobbing. Numb, and yet sobbing. It was absurd. Whatever had happened then, she just wanted it back. She couldn't say his name. It hurt as if someone had stuck a pin in her heart. Ah, that was feeling. It was. It couldn't be denied. She was gasping with it. It hurt so. One couldn't deny it. She pumped the fin slowly, floated off the sand, up away from the rooftops anchoring their kelp. Sitting miserably at that cafe table, what would they have thought if they had known that 120 years later she would be swimming overhead and Frank dead all that time? End of a dream. Disorientation of a shift from one reality to another. Floating in the dark water brought back some of the numbness. Ah, but there it was, that pinprick pain there inside, insisted. Insisted. Hold on to it forever. Hold on to any feeling you can, any feeling you can dredge up out of all that muck, anything, anything but the numbness. Sobbing in pain was rapture compared to that. And so Michel was proved right again, the old alchemist. She looked around for him. He had swum off on voyages of his own. Quite some time had passed
The others were making their rendezvous in the cone of light before the trawl, like tropical fish in a dark, cold tank, drawn to the light in hopes of warmth, dreamy, slow weightlessness. She thought of John, floating naked against black space and crystal stars. Ah, too much to feel. One could only stand a single shard of the past at a time, this drowned city. But she had made love to John here, too, in a dorm somewhere in the first years. To John, to Frank, to that engineer whose name she could seldom recall, no doubt to others besides, all forgotten, or almost. She would have to work on that. Insist them all, precious stabs of feeling held in her forever, till death did they part. Up, up, up. Among the colorful tropical fish with their arms and their legs, back into the light of day, blue sunlight, ah, God, yes, ears popping, a giddiness, perhaps, of nitrogen narcosis, rapture of the deep, or the rapture of human depth. The way they lived and lived, giants plunged through the years, yes, and what they held on to. Michelle was swimming up from below, following her. She kicked, then waited, waited, clasped him and squeezed hard. Ah, how she loved the other's solidity in her arms, that proof of reality. She squeezed, thinking, thank you, Michelle, you sorcerer of my soul. Thank you, Mars, for what endures in us, drowned or insisted though it may be. Up into the glorious sun, into the wind, strip off the suit with cold, clumsy fingers, pull it off and step out of it chrysalis-like, careless of the power of the female nude over the male eye, then, suddenly aware of it, give them that startling vision of flesh in the sunlight, sex in the afternoon, breathe deep in the wind, goose-pimpling all over with the shock of being alive. I'm still Maya. She insisted to Michelle, teeth chattering. She hugged her breasts and toweled off, luxury of terry cloth on wet skin. She pulled on clothes, whooped at the chill of the wind. Michelle's face was the image of happiness, the deification, that mask of joy, old Dionysus laughing aloud at the success of his plan, at the rapture of his friend and companion. What did you see? The cafe? The park, the canal, and you? Hunt Mesa, the dance studio, Thoth Boulevard, Table Mountain. In the cabin, he had a bucket of champagne on ice, and he popped the cork, and it shot off into the wind and landed lightly on the water, then floated off on the blue waves. But she refused to say any more about it. She wouldn't tell the story of her dive. The others did, and then it was her turn somehow, and the people on the boat were looking at her like vultures, eager to gulp down her experiences. She drank her champagne and sat silently on the upper deck, watching the broad sloped waves. Waves looked odd on Mars, big and sloppy, impressive. She gave Michelle a look to let him know she was all right, that he had done well to send her under. Beyond that, silence. Let them have their own experiences to feed on, the vultures. The boat returned to Dumarthuray Harbor, which consisted of a little crescent of marina-platted water curving under part of the apron of Dumarthuray Crater. The slope of the apron was covered with buildings and greenery, right up to the rim. They disembarked and walked up through the town, had dinner in a rim restaurant, watching sunset flare over the water of Isidus Bay. The evening wind fell down the escarpment and whistled offshore, holding the waves up and tearing spray off their tops, in white plumes crossed by brief rainbow arcs. Maya sat next to Michelle and kept a hand on his thigh or shoulder. "Amazing," someone said, to see the row of salt columns still gleaming down there. And the rows of windows and the maces. Did you see that broken one? I wanted to go in and look, but I was afraid. Maya grimaced, concentrated on the moment.
People across the table were talking to Michel about a new institute concerning the first 100 and other early colonists, some kind of museum, a repository of oral histories, committees to protect the earliest buildings from destruction, etc. Also, a program to provide help for super-elderly early settlers. Naturally, these earnest young men, and young men could be so earnest, were particularly interested in Michel's help, and in finding and somehow enlisting all of the first 100 left alive. 23 now, they said. Michel was, of course, perfectly courteous, and indeed seemed truly interested in the project. Maya couldn't have hated the idea more. A dive into the wreckage of the past as a kind of smelling salts, repellent but invigorating, fine. That was acceptable, even healthy. But to fix on the past, to focus on it, disgusting. She would have happily tossed the earnest young men over the rail. Meanwhile, Michel was agreeing to interview all the remaining first 100 to help the project get started. Maya stood up and went to the rail, leaned against it. Below, on the darkening water, luminous plumes of spray were still blowing off the top of every wave. A young woman came up beside her and leaned on the railing.
"My name is Vendana," she said to Maya while looking down at the waves. "I'm the Green Party's local political agent for the year."
She had a beautiful profile, clean and sharp in a classic Indian look. Olive-skinned, black-eyebrowed, long nose, small mouth, intelligent, subtle brown eyes. It was odd how much one could tell by faces alone. Maya was beginning to feel she knew everything essential about a person at first glance, which was a useful ability, given that so much of what the young natives said these days baffled her. She needed that first insight. Greenness, however, she understood, or thought she did. Actually, an archaic political term, she would have thought, given that Mars was fully green now and blue as well.
"What do you want?"
Vendana said. "Jackie Boone and the Free Mars slate of candidates for offices from this area are traveling around campaigning for upcoming elections. If Jackie stays party chairman again and gets back on the executive council, then she'll continue working on the Free Mars plan to ban all new immigration from Earth. It's her idea, and she's been pushing it hard. Her contention is that Terran immigration can all be redirected elsewhere in the solar system. That isn't true, but it's a stance that goes over very well in certain quarters. The Terrans, of course, don't like it. If Free Mars wins big on an isolationist program, we think Earth will react very badly. They've already got problems they can barely handle. They need to have what little out we provide. And they'll call it a breaking of the treaty you negotiated. They might even go to war over it." Maya nodded. For years, she had felt a heightening tension between Earth and Mars, no matter Michel's assurances. She had known this was coming. She had seen it. "Jackie has a lot of groups lined up behind her, and Free Mars has had a supermajority in the global government for years now. They've been packing the environmental courts all the while. The courts will back her in any immigration ban she cares to propose. We want to maintain the policies as set by the treaty you negotiated, or even widen immigration quotas a bit to give Earth as much help as we can, but Jackie's going to be hard to stop. To tell you the truth, I don't think we know quite how, so I thought I'd ask you." Maya was surprised.
"How to stop her?"
"Yes, or more generally, to ask you to help us. I think it will take unpiecing her personally. I thought you might be interested." And she turned her head to look at Maya with a knowing smile. There was something vaguely familiar in the ironic smile lifting that classic little full-lipped mouth, something which, though offensive, was much preferable to the wide-eyed enthusiasm of the young historians pestering Michel. And as Maya considered it, the invitation began to look better and better. It was contemporary politics, an engagement with the present. The triviality of the current scene usually put her off, but now she supposed that the politics of the moment always looked petty and stupid. Only later did it take on the look of respectable statecraft, of immutable history. And this issue could prove to be important, as the young woman had said. And it would put her back in the midst of things, and of course, she didn't think this consciously, anything that balked Jackie would have its own satisfactions. "Tell me more about it," Maya said, moving down the balcony out of earshot of the others. And the tall, ironic young woman followed her. Michel had always wanted to take a trip on the Grand Canal, and recently he had talked Maya into trying a move from Sabashii back to Odessa as a way to combat Maya's various mental afflictions. They might even take an apartment in the same Praxis complex they had lived in before the Second Revolution. That was the only place Maya thought of as home, aside from Underhill, which she refused even to visit. And Michel felt that coming back to some kind of home might help her. So, Odessa. Maya was agreeable. It didn't matter to her. And Michel's desire to travel there by way of the Grand Canal seemed fine as well. Maya hadn't cared. She wasn't sure of anything these days. She had few opinions, few preferences. That was the trouble. Now Vendana was saying that Jackie's campaign was to proceed along the Grand Canal, north to south, in a big canal cruiser that doubled as campaign headquarters. They were there now, at the canal's north end, getting ready in the Narrows. So Maya returned to Michel on the terrace, and when the historians left them, she said, "So let's go to Odessa by the Grand Canal, like you said." Michel was delighted. Indeed, it seemed to lift from him a certain somberness that had followed the dive into drowned burrows. He had been pleased at its effect on Maya, but for himself it had perhaps not been so good. He had been uncharacteristically reticent about his experience, somehow oppressed, as if overwhelmed by all that the great sunken capital represented in his own life. Hard to tell. So that now, to see Maya responding so well to the experience, and also to suddenly be given the prospect of seeing the Grand Canal, a kind of giant joke in Maya's opinion, it made him laugh, and that she liked to see. Michel thought that Maya needed a lot of help these days, but she knew full well that it was Michel who was struggling.
This ends side two of cassette 16 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 17.